Bienvenue.
Bienvenidos.
Magandang araw sa inyo.
Dobro din.
Bienvenue.
Volcherov. Go
here on Earth.
Here on Earth.
Welcome to Here on Earth.
Here on Earth.
Bienvenido a Here on Earth.
What's this? A piece of toast? A pretzel stick? Popcorn? What blockhead cooked all this? What kind of a Thanksgiving dinner is this? Where's the turkey, Chuck? Don't you know anything about Thanksgiving dinners? Where's the mashed potatoes? Where's the cranberry sauce? Where's the pumpkin pie?
So if you don't have turkey, cranberry sauce, and pumpkin pie, it's not Thanksgiving? Most of us may be sticklers for tradition, like peppermint patty. But actually, Snoopy got the popcorn right, to which he could have added some roasted peanuts and a little braised American buffalo and still be, strictly speaking, in the ballpark. Consider this. If it weren't for the Indians, there would be no Irish potatoes today, no Italian tomatoes, and no Thai chilies. According to my guest this hour, the foods of the Americas have endured as the true New World legacy. And to give credit where credit is overdue, Fernando and Marlena Davina spent 11 years researching native recipes and traditions for the Smithsonian National Museum of the American Indian. I'm Jean Faraca. You're listening to Here on Earth, Radio Without Borders, making people-to-people connections. This hour, foods of the Americas. Throughout the indigenous world, food sources and traditions have strong spiritual connotations. They hold the tribe together and they give it its meaning and identity. What have we lost? What are we missing? We're at 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Our email address is hereonearth@wpr.org. Food in the Native American tradition is not meant to be simply eaten, but ritualized, ceremonialized, danced, sung, and even worshipped. Joining us by telephone from Washington State, food journalists and co-authors of the wonderful cookbook Foods of the Americas, Fernando Davina, who has been an executive chef at several acclaimed restaurants. Fernando, welcome to Here on Earth.
Thank you. Happy to be here today.
And joining us as well, Marlena Davina, who is a member of the Little Shell Tribe of Ojibwe. Marlena, welcome to Here on Earth.
Thank you, Jane. We're happy to be here.
So this was a labor of love for both of you, I gather.
It was. Because of my heritage, my indigenous heritage, my husband became very involved with cooking indigenous foods for the contemporary palate, and we've been together for almost 23 years, so it's been a passion of his, and we turned it into a passion that so far has come into this book.
So what needs to be corrected in terms of how we think about the origins of our foods? Jack Weatherford gave us a wonderful book some years ago, Indian Givers, and reminded us that the Irish wouldn't have survived without potatoes that the Peruvian Indians gave them. But you've taken it a little bit farther.
Well, I think Weatherford, his writing has been inspirational for more than one generation. Certainly, it has been for us. We've taken his cues on many of our lines of research. But I think that the principal and underlying message that Jack Weatherford was getting across is that the enduring gift that the Americas provided for the world was the foods and the food ways, and that's really where we leapt forward with regards to that that simple but lasting and important statement.
Well, here's what most people think. that, yes, okay, we understand that pumpkins, you know, were a New World plant, that tomatoes, the Italians would still be making their pastas with beets and carrots if it weren't for the discovery of tomatoes in the New World. We know all that, but our notion is that the Indians didn't know what to do with these things.
Yes, so that is a widely misunderstood error or fallacy, because there were cuisines that were highly sophisticated at the time of the conquest, and those were well documented, in fact, and from a historical standpoint thereafter. The Aztec and the Mayan cultures being of the among the first that were touched by the European explorers were already well versed in not only agriculture but also in animal husbandry as well, where Muscovy duck was being bred and kept in captive as a food, as was turkey, wild turkeys and other animals. So there was also a widespread aquaculture prevalent throughout the Caribbean and the southern or southeastern northern hemisphere, where fish weirs and oyster beds and a myriad of shellfish were being farmed, so to speak.
Mm. Also, the people hybridized corn. It wasn't just growing around with the big corn. They hybridized it from teosinte, a grass, and over hundreds of years, they figured out how to hybridize it to turn it into a big ear of corn. That just didn't happen. The people down in the desert area in the Arizona, and that in the where there's seemingly no water, there actually was more water before it was dammed, but they dug hundreds of miles of canals to water their crops, and these people were busy agriculturalists.
And I think the Peruvian Indians actually were the first to freeze dry potatoes. I think I remember reading that in Jack Weatherford's book.
Yes, that technology, freeze drying, was its origins begin there. The alpine and subalpine area of Peru,
in the Andes,
where the potatoes are believed to have originated, were just by virtue of regional influences, were allowed to dry and then freeze.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a few dishes that are still widely consumed in those in regions of the Andes, other countries that share the Andes, that freeze drying was is centuries old.
And also, they used tears, didn't they, in planting?
Yes.
And there's a photograph in your book, an archival photograph of a waffle shape in planting.
Yes, the waffle technology was and continues to be a dry land farming process where the land immediately surrounding a potentially waterfall or area located within the vicinity where water might run would be plotted, so to speak, with furrows that would might be about 4 to 6 feet or larger, depending on the crop. And within those sort of sunken areas, they would then flood that area with subsequent rainfall water that was diverted.
Go ahead.
You can actually see that driving around in the Phoenix area, where people have insisted on planting grass, and a lot of the yards will be sunken, and so it'll hold water.
I see. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so that technology is actually adapted from that that ancient process.
Well, it makes sense that people who are working with a lot of adverse conditions and don't have refrigeration, after all, and have to get through long winters would have to develop ingenious ways of preserving their food. And
that's true. Food preservation has been out of necessity, and what's sort of a lovely continuum of food preservation is the flavor profiles that we still enjoy, and dried meats are certainly, and dried fruits are all so popular today because they do retain their nutrients, but they're also flavors that are sort of timeless.
Like beef jerky?
Exactly.
What was the traditional method of jerking meat?
Well, like the potato, charqui or jerky, they believe was potentially attributed to a pre-Andean culture, perhaps the Quechua, and the they dried meat. Principally, what Darwin called what he thought to be or claimed to be the finest eating meat, and it was a sort of a distant relative of the ostrich. But this bird, which is called rhea, is now being raised here, even in North America, for its plumage and for its leather-like hide. Is also a fine eating animal, but the charqui was made from that, and alpaca and llama as well. And essentially it was a meat that was sliced with the grain very thinly, flavored after a fashion, but generally very lightly, and then hung to dry, and then used to either as a food to be principally restored with water or with other flavorings.
Now, you've been talking primarily about agricultural peoples. What about the nomads?
The hunter-gatherers?
Yeah.
Well, I think charqui is really an extension of that, and the real benefit is through evolution. There has been the technological advances with regards to the foods, the agricultural elements that have been brought to the fore, and then those are, you know, were all sort of a benefit of that advancement to add vegetables that have been rather than foraged foods. But I think that foraged foods, which are, in my opinion, widely underused, were used regularly as well.
When did the pot come in? I mean, wasn't that the gift of Europeans?
No, the Native Americans have and still make baskets that are completely watertight, pots out of clay. They've had pots for centuries, eons.
Okay.
Or pot-like vessels. One of the Midwestern cultures, the Mississippian cultures, you were ceramicists, and but also. For nomadic tribes, it was not uncommon to build a fire near a tree, a stump, the stump being hollowed, and that being used for a vessel in which they would either allow the foods to cook within moisture that was added to that, or that there were hot rocks that were dropped into the mixture to make a stew-like food. So that technology has been around for centuries, and there's also widely accepted now evidence that there was a pre-ice age cultures employing agricultural or domestication of wildlings as many as 50 million years ago. So this is all kind of taking on a whole new perspective in terms of the timing and so on, and the sort of myth of advancements when contact was made with the old world.
We're going to take a quick break, and we'll be right back with Fernando and Marlena Devia, who are the co-authors of Foods of the Americas, Native Recipes and Traditions from the Smithsonian National Museum of the American Indian. I'm Jean Faraca. You're listening to Here on Earth. We're at 1-800-642-1234.
Hear all about it on the Ideas Network. From education to the economy, from politics to popular culture, we cover it all on the Ideas Network. We look for guests with different viewpoints so you won't hear just one side of an issue. Make up your own mind with the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Support for Wisconsin Public Radio comes from 1-800-Bakery.com. Cakes, confections, and pastries delivered direct from bakeries to homes and businesses across America. On the web at 1-800-Bakery.com.
Since 9/11 and the subsequent bombings in London and elsewhere, many people have come to view the world through a filter of anxiety. But what's the source of that fear, and who benefits from it? On the next Here on Earth, share your perspectives when we team up with Radio Netherlands for a special program on fear and civil liberties. This hour, we're talking with Fernando and Marlena Divina, co-authors of the book Foods of the Americas, Native Recipes and Traditions. For many American Indians, food is more than sustenance. It's also of vital cultural significance. Salmon, buffalo, berries, acorns, wild rice, tomatoes, chocolate, and especially corn, where these indigenous staples flourish. They have become a central part of Native American ceremonies and creation stories. I'm wondering if we in America have adapted these traditions and have developed some of our own. They may be in danger of being lost. We'd like to hear from you if you have family stories or your own family myths surrounding the foods that you cherish as the centerpiece of your Thanksgiving feast, perhaps, or other celebrations throughout the year that center on food. What are they? What are their origins? Do you know, and will you share them? 1-800-642-1234. We've been talking about the rather sophisticated agricultural techniques that pre-conquest Indians of the Americas developed. What happened after the conquest? What happened as a result of conquistadors, for example, landing in Central and Latin America? How were the food traditions affected? Marlena?
Well, one of the wonderful things that the Native American people of the Americas did was they gave them a lot of our food, which was taken back to Europe, the tomato to Italy. They took back a lot of the different foods and introduced them to Europe. That was probably one of the most wonderful things that happened at that time.
Additionally, the embrace of old world techniques and recipes we've all benefited from that, so that we now have our own cuisine here in America.
Well, it's hard to describe because it's so various. And I'm wondering what happened, for example, when cocoa crossed over to the old world and was taken up by the Spanish. What's the difference between the drink that the Aztecs called the drink of the god, the nectar of the gods, and the way it developed into German chocolate cake?
Sure. Well, fundamentally, I think that the significant disparity between cocoa in Europe and cocoa in the New World is the addition of cow's milk, where cocoa was made into principally alone with water or with corn or corn meal in the form of etole. That made a significant change, and that was principal and fundamental in terms of adding milk to that. The other, of course, was the refinement then, or the super refinement of the natural resource into chocolates that we know today.
So can you sort of track the cycle whereby these native foods of the Americas get transported elsewhere in the world and then mix and mingle with local culinary traditions and then come back to us, as you've just mentioned, as our own now well-developed and extremely various food traditions of the New World, of the Americas.
Sure. I think one of the principal or significant contributions to the food network was that it would follow the same road as the spice and the Silk Road travel. So all trade was a first to experience these new foods that were incorporated into the thoroughfares of the merchants that were traveling throughout that time and then subsequently. One great example is polenta, where now the Italians have, there are sixth and seventh, I think, probably beyond that, generations of families that have been and communities, whole entire communities that are centered around growing corn specifically for polenta, milling it, the sale of it, and consuming it, and that has found its way back to American tables in the form of polenta, either creamy or grilled.
And that's fairly recent that you find polenta showing up on menus in American restaurants.
It is, and it is, although it's probably been here as early as immigration. It certainly hasn't been popularized until recently.
Polenta has become a staple, or it really got some northern Italians through some very hard times.
Yes, it did. We spent some time in Italy and continue to enjoy our discussion and discourse with our colleagues in Italy. And in 2000, we presented what they call ARC foods for slow food, and corn was among them.
Uh-huh.
And we had a very lively discussion with Deborah Madison and Evan Kleiman of Los Angeles and a family of polenta producers in Italy. And it was, I think we... the striking similarity in terms of the reliance upon corn was probably the most resounding commonality. And then, of course, the net is enjoying corn for its flavor, certainly.
You know,
I think it's sad, though, how you can't find a good ear of corn in Italy, though. They don't seem to serve it as the way we eat it, you know, a fresh ear of corn.
That's because grano turco, which strangely enough translates as Turkish grain, was really thought of as food for animals. I mean, the corn on the cob, as we know it. And I think it's a much more tough varietal. It's not the highly hybridized sweet corn that we enjoy during harvest season here in the Midwest, especially.
Yeah, that's a good point. Most of the corns that were being processed in the New World at the time were all underwent a slaking process and were further fabricated.
Hmm. You know, apropos of food derived from corn, here's a story that comes from your book. I noticed that you have a recipe for arepas.
Yeah.
And I was introduced to arepas through my husband, who grew up in Colombia and Venezuela. I had never heard of arepas, but he didn't know that these are foods that this is a food tradition that is actually derives from Native Americans.
Yes, it is. Arepas there's some form of that corn dumpling all throughout the New World, essentially.
And very, very, you can just do a million different things with arepas. It's a little bit like pancakes or crepes. You know, a million different ways of making crepes, million different ways of making arepas. You can have them for breakfast, for lunch, for a snack, for dinner, for all kinds of sauces, different sauces. Very, very, very flexible food.
Yes, I think they all are tamales, sumitas. They're very similar in that they're a lovely accompaniment and they carry the flavor so nicely. And they're filling as well.
Mm-hmm. And cheap. Very inexpensive.
Yeah.
You can make lots of arepas with very little cornmeal and feed a whole family for practically nothing. Another great benefit of foods from a frugal people. We're at 1-800-642-1234. We're talking with Fernando and Marlena Divina, co-authors of Foods of the Americas. It's an extraordinary book produced by the Smithsonian National Museum of the American Indian. Our latest addition to the Smithsonian opened, I think it was now, what, in its second or third year?
Just moving into the second year. Anniversary was the 24th of September.
Uh-huh. And there is a cafe at that museum which features some of the recipes that you include in this cookbook. The Mitzitam Cafe?
That's correct. The Mitzitam Cafe has been, by all measure, a tremendous success. Foods of the Americas, the mission of our principal mission was to integrate the experience there with the exhibit so that attendees could experience the entire process, food being and food way being principal and central to most cultures. It was significant to be able to then sample those technologies or the products of the technologies that are being presented there.
Mm-hmm.
The basketry, the eating implements, and the agricultural aspects and the hunting implements and so on that are integral to a life way that's based around food.
Well, what can you eat at the Mitzitam Cafe?
At the Mitzitam Cafe, there's five regions. One of the kitchens was established so that it could mirror a specific exhibit at any given time. But there's foods representative of Mesoamerica, foods of the Northeast Woodland region, foods of the Salmon Nation and of the plains.
And so, for example, what, fry bread?
There is fry bread available there, but it's presented in what we believe to be a method in which would probably have been consumed. Fry bread is right now quite a controversial food. I think there are those that believe that it was a product of post-World War and post-internment, where it's commodity food at its worst, and with the diabetes being an issue.
Uh-huh.
However, we believe that a form of fry bread has been made long before those dried milk and those types of things
and wheat
were being used.
Mm-hmm.
And combined with acorn flour, for example, mesquite flour that's prevalent throughout the Southwest, and other flours.
So I'm still trying to get a sense of what I could order for lunch at the Mitzitam Cafe.
Yes. Well, the Mitzitam Cafe, you could order tamales. You could order roasted turkey.
Mm-hmm. You could have roasted salmon.
Those sound very, very good.
Pumpkin soup.
I had that on my Thanksgiving table yesterday. Pumpkin soup. I'm wondering what you had on your Thanksgiving table, and if you've given credit where credit is due to the origins of these wonderful foods of the New World that we've learned to do so much with, and that the rest of the world has been so influenced by. Salmon, buffalo, berries, acorns, wild rice, tomatoes, chocolate, and so on. We're at 1-800-642-1234. We have Karen joining in from Lansing, Iowa. Hi, Karen.
Hi. This is really fascinating. I'm starting to drool.
That's a good sign.
I wanted to ask about the idea. I love Native American food, and I live in an area where there's a lot of organic farming. A lot of us, you know, live and eat organically what grows around here. And I'm wondering if you'd care to comment on the idea that it is healthier, both physically and spiritually, for people to eat the food that grows in their native area or habitat, you know, like the corn from one area, or the grain mm-hmm. that grows in another area like that, the buffalo from the plains, you know, and whatever, like you know, or if it's, you know, a good idea, just eat anything you can find anywhere if it tastes good.
Marlena, I think this is a good question for you.
I feel real strongly about that. I agree with you that you should be eating I believe you should eat the foods of your area. I've cut out wheat out of my diet. A lot of the Native Americans with diabetes, it's food related. And I think if we go back to eating organic would be, of course, perfect. But eating our original foods, I think, would help our diets. I know in your area there's also hunters, and we have a lot of recipes for deer and pheasant and turkey and goose and
venison
and the fish in your areas. We have recipes for your, you know, the fish that you have in your lakes.
Mm-hmm.
And so yes, I completely agree with that.
You know, there's
also the turtle stew they serve at the rendezvous. That's pretty good.
Turtle stew at the rendezvous, really made from turtle meat?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, wow. From snapping turtles?
I'm not sure what kind they are, but they grow pretty big in the river here, the Mississippi.
Well, those are snapping turtles.
And, okay.
And I think you have to be very skilled to know how to go hunt for them. It's a seasonal thing because you have to get them when they're dormant.
Okay.
Otherwise, you can lose an arm.
I can believe it.
Yeah.
We have one old grandfather in the river near here who's over a yard across.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
I'm sure it's just like with your hunting and fishing licenses here in Washington State.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you so much, Karen.
Thank you.
Pleasure to hear from you. We're at 1-800-642-1234. It would be fun, I think, to talk about the foods that have come to us from indigenous peoples and the things that we've done to them to alter them, to experiment with them. For example, I think Chuck has something to say about that in Waupaca. Chuck? Hello,
hi.
Chuck. Hi.
I remember, I'm 64, and I remember my mother's stuffing for the turkey had a special flavor to it that was very compelling. And I used to go out in the stairwell and pick at that dressing after the turkey carcass was put out there to cool. And I was in my 30s before I realized that it was the use of rosemary.
Mm.
So I was just wondering how spices work into the conversation that we've had and where they've come from.
Very nice question.
Well, I think that there's plenty of flavorings that come from vicinity. We've been working with the Seri. We just recently relocated from the Southwest, where we were working with Northwestern Mexican group of folks, and they produce what we believe to be among the world's most pungent oregano is what it's in the family of, and it's called the Sonoran oregano. Fantastic flavor, and principally holds a much higher oil content when it's dried, so it's it has a lovely flavor as compared to other oreganos.
You know, I have a question. I know that sage is featured very prominently in many, especially Plains Indians, religious ceremonies. But I wonder if it was ever used for flavoring.
Sage, we're in sitting on overlooking the Columbia River Gorge that has some of the most fantastical topography, which includes probably a dozen or more types of sage that occur simultaneously throughout the basalt cliffs here. And while some of them have a milder flavor, particularly when they're harvested young, and they're lovely for using in marinades, and I've used them here, others are a little bit too strong for that. But yes, absolutely, the sage, the wild sages, and all domesticated herbs are from some wildling at some juncture, whether they're of the old world or of the new world.
We're talking with Marlena and Fernando Divina, co-authors of this fabulous cookbook, which is so much more than a cookbook. It really embeds the great food traditions of the New World. Foods of the Americas, Native Recipes and Traditions. We'd also like to hear from you. 1-800-642-1234. I'm Jean Faraca. You're listening to Here on Earth.
The Ideas Network brings people and ideas together. You can tell your elected representative exactly what you think. You can get a tip on staying fit. You can hear about that book you were thinking of getting and talk to the author if you choose to do so. Bringing people and ideas together. That's the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Support for Wisconsin Public Radio comes from Gallic Traditions, featuring holiday-designed table linens, tea towels, and ceramics from France. Traditional French and Belgian imports available online at gallictraditions.com.
On the next Here on Earth, we will talk about living with fear and the erosion of civil liberties that began in this country after 9/11 and is now spreading throughout Europe. It'll be a Radio Netherlands special. And after that, we will be joined by Parker Palmer. You may have heard Parker on this program during our pledge drive, but he promised to come back and do a live interactive conversation with us on the subject of his latest essay, The Politics of the Brokenhearted. This hour, we are celebrating the amazing diversity of the original foods of the Americas, drawn from this magnificent cookbook just published by the Smithsonian National Museum of the American Indian. 11 years of research went into it. Fernando and Marlena Divina are co-authors. We're at 1-800-642-1234. Fry bread, turkey with Oaxacan black mole. There are 7 different kinds of mole in Oaxaca. Wild rice and corn fritters, venison with juniper and wild huckleberry sauce, Chilean style avocado and shrimp salad. Now that was a surprise to me. I did not know that chilled jumbo shrimp and avocados came to us from Native Americans. Did you? Teach us what you know. 1-800-642-1234. Cindy joins in from Eau Claire.
Hi. I ate at the cafe at the Museum of the American Indian this summer and had wild rice salad with watercress. And it has dried cranberries, pepitas, pine nuts. And the recipe is on the website of the Museum of the Native American.
Oh,
it's great.
What a great contribution. You know, I never thought about watercress, but of course that sprouts in our streams. And it's a wonderful, I don't think it's, you find watercress anywhere else, but in the New World. Am I right about that, Marlena?
Well, we find it when we're out foraging around, and but I haven't looked for it in Europe. Mm-hmm. It's all around here in this area in the Pacific Northwest.
I always think of trout in conjunction with watercress, because I suppose they both come from the same source.
Yeah. Watercress is lovely with all kinds of fish. It's great with meat, too. It's a traditional old world accompaniment to meats.
Mm-hmm. And tell us about the shrimp salad and the avocado. That's from Chile.
Yes, there's the Humboldt Current that's famous in that vicinity, produces some of the most abundant seas for shellfish, and shrimp are among those shellfish that have been produced for ever, really, for since man has been at that site. And avocados probably were brought from somewhere in warmer climes, but that technology in terms of growing and domesticated avocados came from that around that vicinity, it's believed. In terms of the lovely shrimp and avocado salad that we all enjoy, we attribute it to that area.
Now, are you including Hawaii? I know it's a little bit of a stretch in terms of the foods of the Americas.
We did include Hawaii. There's with the Heyerdahl experiment and with subsequent research that has been raising probably more questions than answers, there's a lot of commonality between the Amazon, in fact, the Peruvian cultures and the Southeast. But yes, we did include that as a portion. Senator Sam Anoya was actually one of the principal sponsors that helped develop and bring forward the National Museum of the American Indian for Smithsonian.
What was the Heyerdahl experiment that you referred to?
Tor Heyerdahl believed that Eastern cultures came from the or rather South Pacific cultures came from the East, from South America, and it also, of course, refutes the land bridge theory, so it's an interesting idea.
Uh-huh.
So he set about harvesting wood from the Amazon, building a craft and manning the craft to the Southeast successfully. Under two occasions.
Mm-hmm. Well, I know you mentioned earlier very sophisticated fish farming, and they certainly were doing that, trapping the fish in their estuaries, and also avocados grow in such abundance there, as well as so many other things. But it never occurred to me until I actually visited the islands that they are really very, very similar to native populations.
They are. They have actually their word for potato, sweet potato, is quite similar. They share a vocabulary that in agriculture and in aquaculture, in some cases as well, with those from South America.
Oh, now I'm remembering. You have a recipe for poke.
For pokey, yes.
Pokey.
Yes,
which is it's like a
reef
sushi.
Fish is flavored with the salt there. There's a salt that's been harvested there.
And it's raw, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
And you can find it in great varieties in all kinds of local supermarkets, poke.
Well, you can, yeah. Any fish can be used. In our recipe, we're using tuna. But the Hawaiian sea salt has this red mineral that's part of the process that gives it a specific flavor. And then the Hawaiian cultures use candle nuts, and macadamia nuts are lovely with it as well, although those are from farther south.
I never heard of candle nuts.
Yes. Well, candle nuts were a nut that had so much oil that they used them actually as a torch as well.
Wow.
Not unlike our candle fish up here, or a type of herring in the Northwest.
Huh. 1-800-642-1234. We're talking about native food traditions and the extraordinary variety of them and how they have influenced the cuisines of the world. Gus joins us from Oconto Falls. Hi, Gus.
I have a comment and a question.
Uh-huh.
I grew up in northern Illinois in Dundee, and I believe that was where the Algonquin Indians were at some point, but my follow-up comment is on the watercress. There are a lot of just natural springs all over that area, and at the headwaters of those springs was just a tremendous amount of watercress.
Mm.
And unfortunately, a lot of those springs, they formed creeks, but they were impaired or impacted by local industries pretty dramatically. And I guess my question is, as you know, there's a lot of impaired waters around the United States, and there's contamination, you know, within the food chain of the aquatic life, and also, you know, there's mercury issues in wildlife. And I was just wondering how some of those, the pollutants basically from Western society, they enter into the food chain. I was just wondering how the Native American have dealt with that, and how they've dealt with it or not dealt with it. I heard there was some real problems up in the way up north and the Inuit populations. They just didn't understand how polluted some of the animals got, and then they themselves got sick. But I was just wondering,
yes, that's
very, you
know, true,
if that figures into your recipes, or you have any comments on that.
Thanks, Gus.
Well, I'll take that. It's one of our great tragedies of humankind, but I think there's lots being done by both indigenous and immigrant cultures here in North America, and certainly globally. We are strong advocates of foraging, but we also recognize that wholesomeness is so very important. So this resource, your place of harvesting must be known, not just that the plant is identified, as in mushrooms, for example, but also that the area is not been subject to sprays and those types of things. And you can get that information from through your local forestry service, and also there are many green agencies with publications like Sierra Club, for example. So that's a very good point, very important. But I don't think that it should preclude including natural foods from your area that are harvested, but by all means, they must be collected with respect to the area.
Mm. We have an email message from Jason in Schulzburg. He asks, what special drinks did Native Americans have?
Well, one of the nice ones that we have in our cookbook is a maple drink, and it's simply maple syrup and water. We served that at a luncheon that we put on when the Smithsonian was visiting us at one point, and people were wondering, you know, what is this? This is, you know, this tastes so great. What is this? And it was simply maple syrup and water. Mm. That would be one of them. And then, of course, people have been drinking teas for centuries, rosehip tea.
And in Oaxaca, they have there's a native tradition that uses a special tool for whipping the drink, and there's a very long ceremonial tradition that goes with it. Can you help me with this? I'm not remembering the name of the drink.
I think we spoke to that. It was atole, or a variant of atole, and there's they have a bombilla, or rather a a bombilla is. Is something another culture, but they have a it's a globe-shaped grooved tool.
Exactly.
That you spin in your hands, and sometimes there's rings that have been loosely attached, and these are generally made of the wood of the area.
And it's very nutritious.
It's lovely. It's corn, a very finely ground corn, and also chocolate.
Mm-hmm.
and water that's been steamed and then frothed in a special manner. And it does take, actually, it's a rite of passage for young girls to learn to make this frothy atole that should have a lovely, creamy, smooth head. And
it has to be planted according to the phases of the moon, as I recall.
That's correct.
Very special drink. And used for nursing mothers and for men when they need to do heavy work, and almost like a barn storming.
Well, it's also served
barn raising. Excuse me.
It's also served just as a beverage to enjoy in Oaxaca City throughout the area, although it's and throughout Mexico.
Mm-hmm. We have Gary joining us next from Milwaukee, and open lines for anyone else, 1-800.
I wanted to mention I prepared turkey from alpaca a few weeks ago.
Oh, uh-huh.
But it's a little strong for my liking.
How did you do it?
You have to get the dried meat from Peru. My fiance's Peruvian and brought some back with her.
Uh-huh.
But you prepared, well, I guess traditionally there's a primitive form of potato called ajucos. Or something like that, but I just prepared it with potatoes and rice.
I see. Uh-huh.
Yeah, but one of the best things, there's the Incan beer, the Chicha de Hora.
Yes.
Uh-huh. It's absolutely wonderful.
Yes, it's, there's a similar beverage that's called Chicha Morada.
Mm-hmm.
That's a corn fermented corn beverage that actually is probably the precursor to this the beer that you're referencing.
And is
we
that
had many lovely beers while we were in Cusco and traveling throughout South America.
Is that Incan beer that you mentioned, Gary, commercially available?
Yes, it is. In fact, we tried to make some at home. It didn't turn out so well, so we got some bottled beer. There's one or two brands now available, but traditionally it was just something that people made at home. It wasn't a brewery-type beer.
And what is it made from?
It's made from purple corn, which is sprouted.
Mm.
And then it's cooked with a white corn with what's called habas. I think that's fava beans.
Huh. Yes, uh-huh.
Chancaca, which is like a molasses sugar. And I can't remember a couple of other odd ingredients. But
we have a recipe. There's quite a outcropping of Peruvian specialty foods in restaurants throughout America, I believe. Do you find that to be true, Gary?
Yeah, and one of the best things is the chilies, which they call ají. That's the ancient Taino word for chili. that's used in parts of South America, Puerto Rico, the Caribbean. And it's a much different texture and flavor. Instead of being hot in the front of the mouth, it's like hot in the back of the mouth, if that makes sense.
Mm. Yes.
Yeah,
the chicha morada, not incidentally, there is a recipe. It's not fermented, although it could be in our book. And we've made that, we used pineapple and honey to sweeten it with clove and apple. And while those are not particularly traditional, they're very contemporary additions. The purple corn drink it's beautiful to look at, and it's very simple to steep, lovely to drink.
Mm.
Cool. And if I could just get a couple plugs in for the pre-Colombian grains, the quinoa and amaranth, and then I'll hang up.
Okay. Thanks
thank
so,
so
much,
much,
Gary. It's a great contribution. We also got a correction from a listener who tells us that the origin of watercress is actually European. And that's perfect, because the whole idea here was to trace the cycle. Things beginning here and going elsewhere and coming back again. So thank you all for listening and for joining in. And just as a last note, members of the Six Nations gave corn to George Washington and his starving troops to survive the grueling, foodless winter at Valley Forge. So we have much to be grateful for, and for your joining in with us this hour, Marlena and Fernando.
Thanks so much. Pleased to be here,
thank
and good eating to all.
And to you. And we have put a link to the recipe for wild rice salad that's served at the Museum Cafe on our website. Just go to hereonearth.org and look under archives, and you'll find a link to Fernando and Marlena Divina and their book, Foods of the Americas. Plus, you can post your thoughts at our web forum and subscribe to our podcast. And for a copy of the program, call the radio store, 1-800-747-7444. This is program number 1126K. Here on Earth is produced by Carmen Jackson, La Peruviana, Joe Hartke, Lisa Boo, Heather Sturr, Steve Zelasnik, Lisa Nett, and myself, in cooperation with the Division of International Studies at the University of Wisconsin, Madison, international.wisc.edu. I'm Jean Faraca.